The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Extra Admin Special and Playoff Preview. UEFA's decision to take the Europa League to Azerbaijan looks increasingly ridiculous as Mkhitaryan refuses to travel to Baku, as well as most of the sponsors and the fans. Not to be outdone, FIFA decide to sell tickets to the Women's World Cup in a completely random order because none of us want to sit next to our friends or family. The head of La Liga piles into City and PSG will do the latest managerial appointments. Clark takes the Scotland job, Graham Potter at Brighton, Batistuta to Middlesbrough. Well, that is just a rumour. All that, plus an intervention from the Ghanaian president, your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly Extra. I should stress the Ghanaian president has not intervened on the pod as yet, Barry, but there is still time, isn't there?
I thought you were going to say you arrived home to find the Ghanaian president and his... you know, minders and advisors waiting for you to tell you drink too much and it's time to maybe knock it on the head.
Pouring the very old bottle of eggnog down the sink that's been on the fridge for the last 20 years. That is the voice of Barry Glendenning. Marcus Bean joins us on the panel today. How are you, Marcus?
Good, thanks, mate.
Not very footballery to be in the Guardian studios just after the season's finished. You should be in Magaluf, you know, taking Akinfenwa's stuff out of his bedroom and putting it on the balcony and then drinking wee out of a shoe or something.
Touching Bayo's gear is suicide, so I definitely wouldn't be doing that.
Is that right? Does he get upset about that?
Yes, that's really? One of his pet hates. You can banter him and say anything you like to him banter-wise, okay. But touch his gear and, yeah, you
well,
get
even
it.
Just like, you know, just touch it with just one finger.
I suppose you could touch it gently, but hide it or cut it up and you're in for trouble.
Okay. I don't have you down as a... cutting up other people's clothes type footballer, or does every footballer do that?
No, I'm
that...
more of a crickets in the car kind of footballer.
Oh, right. Have you actually put?
Yeah, I've done that to one of the boys, Joe Jacobson. Yeah, he cut one of my gear, so I went to the local pet shop, got some crickets, stuck them in his car.
How many crickets? Do you buy them by the gallon?
A tub load. I think they're for some sort of spider. I can't remember which one.
Oh, okay.
I was putting them sticking in his car. He's still finding them weeks later, jumping around. So it's quite fun.
I really thought better of you, Marcus.
No, you've got to take it to that level where they just never come back.
And right. That, okay, is that the level?
It's like going into prison and just, you know, finding the hardest man in there and punching his lights out.
A debut on the pod for Ali Maxwell from Not the Top 20 podcast. How are you, Ali?
Very well, very well. Right. Why did we choose that name for the podcast? I've no idea.
Once you realise what it means, you do understand what it is, right? It's an anti-Premier League love of shit football podcast.
It's a big statement. And honestly, we set it up in my front room, and you realise when you're submitting your podcast for the first time that you need things like artwork and a name for it. And we couldn't come up with any good ones. So Not the Top 20 was what we ended up on. And 3 years on, I'm just about getting used to it. But yeah.
All right. Well, look, we've plugged it now, so you have
did,
to
did
stay.
Did you consider going for the bottom 70 podcasts?
72.
72, sorry, yes.
I think that's already been used by many similar outlets, so we left that one.
Fine. Right, well, let's start. We'll start, you know, not quite at EFL level, but it is the Europa League finals, so, you know, it's not that important. But it's becoming increasingly important, mainly because fewer and fewer people are going to Baku. Sponsors are pulling out. Well, they're not going. Fans aren't really going. And now Henrikh Mkhitaryan, who is Armenian, will not be playing in the final because it's in Azerbaijan. Henrikh says, having considered all the current options, we had to take the tough decision for me not to travel with the squad. It's the kind of game that doesn't come along very often for us players, I must admit. Hurts me a lot to miss it. I'll be cheering my teammates. Let's bring it home. You have probably heard the background by now. I got this from someone called Anoush Chakilian, a senior writer at the New Statesman, discussing the slice of mountainous territory known as the Nagorno-Karabakh. It's disputed by the two countries. In practice, it's Armenian. The population is 95% ethnic Armenian. It has strong ties to Armenian, but it's a self-declared republic, but legally it's part of Azerbaijan. So there are no diplomatic relations between those countries. It is a complete mess, Barry. People have called for Arsenal to boycott. People have called for Arsenal and Chelsea to boycott or to move the game. What do you think?
I've written a column about this, which should be going up later today, saying that I think Arsenal should boycott it, with the caveat, obviously, that doing so would mean they'd incur severe punishment from UEFA. They'd straight off the bat get a €500,000 fine. They'd probably get an extended ban from European competition, which, say, if they were in the Champions League, would could cost them up to €50 million a year in revenue, which for Arsenal is a lot of money. And then obviously there's knock-on effects because the quality of player they would be able to afford would decrease. But I think, and people will probably call me a wishy-washy guardianista liberal for saying so, I think at some point you have to weigh up the value of human decency over the pursuit of glory and trophies and the bottom line. And I think if Arsenal made a stand, the amount of goodwill they would generate for themselves, I'm not sure you could put a price on that. And I think a lot of people would support them. It would create huge global headlines and it would really put UEFA on the back foot. As things stand, Arsenal have made this very easy for UEFA by kind of meekly acceding to their wishes and not forcing them to defend themselves more.
I sort of, well, I fully agree. I don't think there's really much of a counter argument or any sort of pro UEFA argument here. It's clearly one of the least tasteful things that we've seen on such a large scale. And it would be great to see both clubs show some sort of solidarity with each other, for their fans, for Mkhitaryan, and on all of these issues. And I agree with Barry. I'm kind of interested in knowing what it's like within these teams. Of course, there's so many employees of a football club, from the players right the way up to the admin staff to the people making the top decisions. And I wonder what the appetite is within those, whether they're all saying we want to boycott, but for X political reason, we cannot do that. Or whether for many of them, I don't know, maybe Marcus could give us some insight in political terms within a dressing room. Is there within footballers and with people within the clubs still this sort of bloody-mindedness that actually we've played a whole season here, and for all the reasons that Barry listed, that the issues that Arsenal would have should they made a statement like that, whether it's still somehow not worth it for their pursuit of glory? So that's where I'm just interested to see, or I would be interested to know what everyone's thinking within the club.
Yeah, Marcus, would the players be viewing this in a different way to, say, Mkhitaryan just being injured or being suspended? You know, is it just he's not there, let's get on with it?
I think so. I think there'll be a slight appetite from a few players who to be militant and talk about boycotts, etc. But generally, in a change room, there's just not enough of those characters to swing it that way. Unfortunately, I agree with everything Barry said. It'll be great if Arsenal done it, but ultimately, as you said, financially, that will cripple them for years. So I can understand why they haven't. From a player's point of view, it's a bit upsetting from the simple fact that you look forward to that game for your whole career. And there's players in there who now probably feel they can't really talk about it around him. I can imagine that dressing room is going to be pretty flat at the moment, because you just don't want to upset a player, one of your teammates.
UEFA say, working alongside Arsenal, UEFA sought and received assurances regarding the player's safety in Azerbaijan from the highest authorities in the country. As a result of these guarantees, a comprehensive security plan was developed and given to the club. While the club acknowledges the efforts that UEFA and the Azeri government have gone into this matter, we respect the personal decision not to travel with the player. The Azerbaijani FA said it was disappointed. We very much regret this unwarranted decision taken. The Azerbaijani UK ambassador said, my message to Mkhitaryan would be, you're a footballer. You want to play football, go to Baku. You're safe there. If you want to play the issue, that's a different story.
That sounded more like a threat than an assurance. I mean, the thing is, Azerbaijan, as a matter of course, don't let Armenians into the country. They won't let anyone whose name ends in IAN into the country. Some Arsenal supporters of Armenian descent have been refused access or
visas.
And they can't guarantee Mkhitaryan's safety. I believe he's blacklisted because at some point he made an ill-advised sort of official visit to this disputed area. But they can talk is cheap, but when he's out there on a football pitch, his safety cannot be guaranteed, nor can that of his teammates. So he's, I suppose, taken one for the team. And as I say, a column I open with the word, you know, that US military phrase, leave no man behind. But Arsenal couldn't leave him behind quick enough.
It's tricky for Arsenal, though. I mean,
I think it's tricky, but I think the way they've handled this has been absolutely pathetic. It's so feeble. They, you know, they put out a statement saying, we're sad. You know, we're angry. We're furious. This is outrageous. No, we're sad, but we'll get on with it. I was at their media open day on Wednesday with Amy Lawrence, and Unai Emery sort of towed the party line, we're sad. You know, obviously, it's the hierarchy who've and Mkhitaryan who've arrived at this decision. And but he couldn't stress the importance of the game quickly enough, you know. And I'm sad about this, but don't want to talk about it anymore. I'm not going to criticise UEFA. And now let's talk about how important this game is. I think, you know what, it's not that important in the cosmic scheme of things.
I wonder how up for it most of the Chelsea players and the management team are. Sarri obviously unhappy being asked if this matters for his future at the club as manager. Chelsea are already in the Champions League next year. They've won a Europa League. They've won Champions Leagues in the and there's definitely a sense, I think, from the club that the players are quite happy to put what has on paper still been a successful season, but clearly has been behind the scenes difficult, kind of put that season behind them, and probably most of them will enjoy a bit of a summer rest. So it's a fascinating backdrop on so many levels. I mean, the other thing is that Baku will host European Championship games next summer. And you know, leaving aside the political situation, the travel situation, the infrastructure situation is a disgrace in itself, even before we got into this topic. And I read somewhere that the games they're hosting are knockout games, which means that you're not going to know which teams are even in those games until the end of the group stage, which means, as we've seen, booking travel to those destinations at short notice is simply unfeasible. So you have to question whether those games should or will go ahead
Do you think, I mean, because this was organised in 2017, Baku was picked then, there is a case to have European finals not just in Western Europe, right? Or do you, because almost none of them have been in Eastern Europe. You know, we want to spread football to everywhere. That is in principle, a good message.
Yeah.
They've just not picked the right place to do it.
But do you really think that the reason UEFA picked Baku was because they wanted Azerbaijan to have a final?
Yeah. I should point you in the direction of a piece by Paul Doyle yesterday, I think, which made a lot of those points. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Matt Hughes in the Times saying a number of sponsors have followed the lead of both clubs, returning a significant proportion of the tickets that they were given. Arsenal and Chelsea planning to return a combined total of more than 6,000 tickets. So yeah, it's a complete disaster.
And obviously, if Arsenal were to boycott, which they won't, but say they did, their fans who have already... Because me and Amy were arguing about this on the way back. Well, on the way to and the way back from the training ground. She didn't really agree with me. But she was saying, you know, pointed out the fans who have already outlaid money would suffer. But I think if you love Arsenal enough to go to that expense, to go to Azerbaijan for a final, you probably love them enough to take the hit if they took a moral stand. Chelsea fans, obviously, they would suffer too.
Well, you mentioned Chelsea, and we mentioned what Sarri said about in the press conference. If his entire career at Chelsea depends on this result, they might as well sack him now. Giroud signed a new contract. I mean, I suspect, Marcus, they've just got to keep anybody, right? Giroud could have said, right, this is how much I want. I'm a footballer who plays for Chelsea and you need them.
Yeah, that's right. Chelsea in a bit of bother. Looks like Sarri will probably leave at the end of the season with Italy calling. And yeah, I think Giroud re-signing shows that they really need all hands on deck.
Do you think he will go?
I think he will. I wouldn't let him go if I was Chelsea. I think I'd stick by him. I think his savvy ball, as they call it, project is in the early stages. But I think I can see green shoots and it could be successful. But why does he need all the stick that he's been got, and you know, the trouble with Kepo and all the talk of the dressing room unrest? If I was him, I'd probably go back to Italy.
I don't think he's been enjoying it very much, if I'm honest. I'm not sure that he has welcomed some of the questioning aspects of his management style by the fans, by the media, possibly some of the players internally as well. If he has got interest from some of Italy's biggest clubs and somewhere where he is hugely respected, he strikes me as the type of man who, for whom that's quite important. From a Chelsea perspective, well, it feels like for the first time since Michael Emanalo left a few years ago that there's an acceptance that they can't just ride from manager to manager and change the manager every 12, 24 months, basically starting a whole new system and a whole new recruitment process, which is why we've seen reports of a Petr Cech, director of football, sporting director sort of role. That's obviously pretty ubiquitous in the Premier League now, but Chelsea have been acting essentially with no one between the manager and Marina Granovskaya, who sort of runs the club, really, on behalf of Abramovich. So it's interesting that they are finally accepting a new approach, and possibly if that means building a mid-term, let's not say long-term in football, but a mid-term vision for the club, whether they might choose a different manager to start taking that forward, especially with the transfer ban.
Do you think they would try and take Frank Lampard from Frank Lampard's Derby County?
I've no idea. I think, look, from what he's done in management, there's nothing to suggest he should be the next Chelsea manager. Of course, there's a lot more to it than that, and you shouldn't just focus on that. He's getting a lot of plaudits for essentially 45 minutes of football the other day against Leeds, and a good season, but not a great one. The benefit, I suppose, is that within his staff is Jody Morris, and I can't remember the name, but a very popular former fitness coach at Chelsea. So it would be people going back to a club that they understand that they are very much respected within. And if there is a transfer ban in place, well, one of the things Frank Lampard has shown in his 1 year in management so far is actually getting a lot out of what are some incredibly talented young players, some of whom are on loan from Chelsea, of course, in Mount and Tomori, but others, Wilson from Liverpool as well. So if there's a transfer ban, if Chelsea are going to want to give Reece James, Tammy Abraham, Mason Mount, Tomori, any of those game time, I can kind of see why it would make sense. And of course, there'd be goodwill from the fans, which can take you part of the way to having a happier time.
Back to football administration. Women's World Cup ticketing. Great opening line from Susie Rack yesterday. Following the still simmering fury over UEFA's choice of Baku for the Europa League final, its corporate-heavy ticket policy for both its showpiece men's competitions, FIFA's given us an outstanding proverbial hold-my-beer moment. 18 days before host France opened the Women's World Cup against South Korea at the Parc des Princes, a number of fans have found out that tickets purchased at the same time are not next to one another. The official Women's World Cup Twitter account responded with, "Dear fans, we've noted some of your comments. Re your tickets. When we placed your order, a message indicating not all seats would be located next to each other did appear before confirmation of your purchase. Unfortunately, we'll not be able to modify your order." Barry, how is this a thing? Surely it's harder to sell tickets that are not next to each other than ones that are next to each other.
I presume so. I never sold tickets for anything really other than a raffle, but they were always like sequential.
Exactly.
I've bought tickets for your end of season due. I buy them every year. I never win anything. I still think there may be some corruption going on, but they're also sequential. You know, they come in little booklets with numbers. I really don't know. It seems quite a feat to mess up something like that. But if anyone's going to be able to do it, it's FIFA.
They said, FIFA, an exception could be made for parents whose seats are not next to seats of their underage children. They could.
That's a nice touch.
Isn't it?
That's a really nice touch.
Susie spoke to loads of people on Twitter. Someone called Brenna Polk, her friend purchased 5 tickets on the 20th of October for each of the semi-finals and the finals. This is the Champions Package in Lyon. To find out on Monday, they've been handed seats in rows 1, 16 and 17 of block 429 and 2 in row 17 of block 30.
It's like flying with a low budget airline, isn't it, where you have to pay extra to choose your seat. Did everyone miss that option?
I think that could
I wasn't going to mention brand names, but I think we all know
that could be the play. They're going to charge extra to choose your seats now at football.
But it's beyond,
and then they'll have speedy entries. Get in first.
Yeah.
Oh, the whole thing.
Unbelievable.
It's unbelievable, isn't it? Some good news, though, only because there wasn't enough time to make it bad. Plans to expand the 2022 World Cup to 48 teams have been abandoned by FIFA. Gianni Infantino last year wanted to expand it from 32 to 48 for 2022. It's still going to happen in 2026. The change would have required Qatar to share hosting duties with other countries in the region, some other countries that they don't really have a particularly good relationship with. After a thorough and comprehensive consultation process, the change could not be made now. FIFA also explored the possibility of Qatar hosting a 48-team tournament on its own, has decided not to pursue those plans as there was not enough time for a detailed assessment of the potential logistical impact.
I'd like to know how thorough that consultation was or how long it took, because basically you show someone a list. These are the five countries that we want to co-host. And then you go, well, three of them obviously won't want to because they hate Qatar. And the other two, yeah, their football infrastructure isn't really all that.
I mean, you sort of imagine, you could see FIFA saying, ah, sod it, we'll have 48 teams, and having lots of purpose-built stadiums and then just some people on a pitch out just in the middle of nowhere. But anyway, at least it means, what I was about to say, this is the last World Cup that'll be good, but I have no...
The Winter World Cup.
The Winter World Cup.
To that one. Well, it's nice for the people of Qatar, of course, spreading the game, as we've discussed earlier, is such a central tenet to UEFA and to FIFA. So just really thrilled for the football mad people of Qatar that they've got this opportunity. And well done, FIFA. They giveth by changing this decision, but they taketh away with the Women's World Cup ticket scandal. So it's a busy week for them, as always.
Yeah.
Man City must be loving all this.
Listen, we will get on to them in just a second. Finally on admin, you'll be pleased to know. The La Liga president says Man City and PSG should be thrown out of Europe. Javier Tebas, he's run Spanish football's top league for the past 6 years. He calls both sides playthings of a state who should be kicked out of European competition for violating FFP. There are clubs who could not care less what their real incomes are when they want to sign a player because they receive incomes from a state. This is no longer sport. He is speaking to an audience of people that will agree with that. He's got to speak for La Liga, right? But Ali, do you agree or disagree? Be prepared on what you say to receive some friendly comments from Man City and PSG fans below the line.
It's a long way from discussing whether Rochdale would be better off playing four or five at the back, which is my general weekly major topic of discussion. Look, Mr. Tebas, Senor Tebas, I should say, has always been quite outspoken on many parts of the game, and with a lot of people with his status, there's always a question of, well, why is he making these statements? Is there some extent to which it is to protect his federation, the Spanish game, the Spanish clubs? You have to say probably that is his job to some extent. At the same time, look, one of the reasons why I don't focus much on the Premier League and on the top of the game is I find discussions like this very difficult. On the one hand, I agree with everything he says. I'm disillusioned with the way that most of the top teams are being run, including Manchester City, including PSG. I find it quite murky and takes away a lot from my absolute love for football. So I find it very difficult to necessarily disagree or get angry with anything that he has said. I also know that there's pretty much every single club, and you can go through them, I imagine, you'd be able to find something distasteful, something that's a bit naughty, something there. So,
well, I tweeted this yesterday. It was interesting because after Monday's pod, we actually had more comments on a podcast than we'd ever had before. A lot of City fans were angry. Some City fans were reasonable.
Still enjoying their very good-humoured treble celebrations.
But I tweeted yesterday, you know, what is the best team you can support in the UK with a completely clear conscience? And maybe this is whataboutery from me. I don't know. But I was just generally interested to see what, you know, clubs that people came up with. And, you know.
Well, I was out for drinks with a few mates and we were mulling over it. And you know, people throwing out a few suggestions. Forest Green came up. Thought, nah, too sanctimonious and vegan.
Oh, they have won a UN award this season for sustainable living through sports.
So. You can't say that. I mean, you can't. Like, there are others you can write. I think Forest Green have got a chance, right?
Yeah, okay, give them a chance. But AFC Wimbledon was the best we could come up with. But then someone said, tweeted me this morning, saying, no, you can't have them because Wally Downs manages them. Which I'm not sure what their problem is with Wally Downs. I've met Wally Downs and I quite like him.
Yeah, there was just, as with many people who say things, some former quotes of his were sort of dredged up around the time of his appointment, which showed some views that that many don't agree with, put it that way.
Yeah,
but I mean, I was just reading the big Guardian piece today about the Premier League profit loss of all the clubs and turnover, etc. I was just glancing at that, and I wondered about Burnley because they appear to have a very acceptable ownership structure. Yep. They have lived within their means, as far as I can tell. They have succeeded on the field, certainly in the last decade, to a great extent. Even when they came down to the Championship from the Premier League, they put together a very smart way of getting back up again in a way that wasn't going to risk the future of the club. So I'm going to shout out Burnley as my answer there.
Okay, so if anybody can find anything wrong with Burnley, let us know. Josh said Brighton, owned by a local fan. Shirt sponsorship goes to the club charity, I think. Bloom has made money from property and gambling, though. So how much do you hate gambling? We sort of wrote off bookies because Norwich...
Yeah, but he's good at gambling.
Oh, that's okay, is it?
He has put £223 million into the club. I saw it in that piece earlier, which is amazing.
Someone mentioned Everton. Where does Mashiri get his money? You know, I don't know. Perhaps I should know. Middlesbrough, Forest Green, Accrington, Stanley. Luton, somebody said. Burnley got a... Burnley is sponsored by bookies, apparently.
That's a big problem. That's a big blow.
Brentford, Exeter, FC United, Manchester, Dulwich, Hamlet got a shout. Lewis did. Martin Bellum, who is the senior social reporter at The Guardian, presumably he's good on these things, said Leighton Orient. Simon said Hearts, a club saved by the fans, soon to be fully fan-owned, shirt emblazoned with Save the Children logo, foregoing a corporate deal. A competent chairwoman in control of the finances, 8,000 supporters pledging monthly, contributing £1.4 million a year. So that's possible. Wickham, someone said, owned by the fans, scrupulous, ingenious partners, one of the longest serving managers in the Football League who players love playing for.
Yeah, I was about to say that definitely would be on the list for sure.
All right. Anyway, we will actually talk about football in part two, previewing the playoffs. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Let's do the playoffs in chronological order then. Saturday, Newport v Tranmere. Ali, who in your heart do you want to win? I want Newport to do it because I think Mike Flynn has been brilliant for them as a manager, and you only really see a lot of them during the cup runs where they've been excellent, but he is a good guy, and I don't want Tranmere to go up because of Mike Dean.
That's a good enough reason.
Those are excellent, excellent reasons. It is win-win, I think, really here for people who cover the EFL all season. For Tranmere, you would have a double promotion, both of them through the playoffs, which is fantastic, and a club who, like many clubs that we recognise as being essentially second-tier clubs or third-tier clubs, sort of fell to its knees to an extent down into the National League. Very hard to get out of that league immediately, and they had to spend some time really rebuilding the club top to bottom. So it'd be fantastic for Tranmere to get into League One. Looking at their average attendance, I think if they were in League One, and you'd expect them to get a bit more if they do go up, they'll be around 6th, 7th, 8th in that tier. So if the discussion about big clubs is something that I find quite tedious and gets used a lot in the EFL. But if you use average attendance as some sort of marker, then you know they'd be well suited to League One football, put it that way, and it'd be an impressive few years for them. And for all the reasons you said, I have been singing songs about Mike Flynn and Newport on our podcast and
literally singing songs.
Well, no, but okay. there's you might have seen a fantastic parody of Empire State of Mind by Alicia Keys and Jay-Z, but Newport State of Mind. And if you haven't seen it, you must go on YouTube and look that up right now.
Sorry, just about that. gaudy-looking chain then followed up with a parody of the parody, criticising the people who made it for not actually being from Newport and getting lots of things wrong.
There you go. So even,
both are excellent.
Just like at the top of the game, there are certain things that you have to point fingers at the things that, you know, you have to dig a little bit deeper. But yeah, I would like to see Newport win. One of the things that you discuss around January, February time in the EFL is when there's the team that has the cup run, how much is it affecting their league form? And it's quite hard to know from the outside, and Marcus can tell us from inside a dressing room how much that does affect your league form. Newport in consecutive seasons have played against Leeds, Leicester, Tottenham, Middlesbrough and Man City. And around those periods, their league form has dipped substantially and they have really failed to threaten the playoffs. And then they put together this amazing run at the end of the season, reminiscent of their run 2 years ago, which saved them from what looked like certain relegation to non-league. So I think it's all set up for Newport to win. They've proved themselves as an excellent cup team. They manage games really well. And they've got a style that you do not want to come up against. A lot of aerial balls into the box. And it's going to be a very hot day at Wembley. So I think Newport will win a close game. And I think that would be a lovely end to well, a new chapter, not the end of the Mike Flynn miracle story.
Are you nodding, Marcus?
Yeah, I played with Flynny at Blackpool and he's full blast. Great guy. And he's obviously done a great job there. He's getting the best out of on a small budget work and done really good job there.
Do you want to fly the flag for Tranmere before Tranmere fans get upset with us?
I must confess this is...
It's not on your mind, is it, with what's on Sunday?
No. Steve McMillan, who works down the sports desk, big Tranmere fan, and he'll be grumpy for ages if they lose. So that's beyond that. I just hope it's a decent game.
The John Aldridge derby, he started his career at Newport, ended it at Tranmere. Has Mike Dean ever revved you?
Yes, he has, I think. I can't remember when, but okay. Yeah. I saw the video of him celebrating. That was quite funny, too.
Listen, I've said it before. Absolutely, if he's standing at the same level as everyone else cheering, I think it's a brilliant moment. As soon as he stands on the barrier, I was about to say get in the sea. Oh, I happily would. Just don't do that. Sunday, Charlton Sunderland. Marcus, you've played against them both this season.
Yeah.
Who's going to win?
Good question. I think Charlton might do it. Sorry, Barry, mate. It's going to be a tight game. Really is. I think they've obviously both got players that they rely heavily on. Aribo for Charlton is an excellent player. One I think could go all the way into the Premier League. And obviously McGeady for Sunderland. I think really it's going to come down to those two players. I think going to make the difference on the day. Game players.
Would you agree with that, Annie?
Not entirely. Yeah. Only because, you know, I think that both teams have a lot of key players, put it that way. From Sunderland's point of view, despite the fact that they have a lot of very recognisable players, more so than most League One clubs, they haven't always played particularly fluid attacking style of football this season. They have struggled to create chances. So Marcus is right. McGeady's individual wizardry and quality has got them out of quite a lot of difficult situations this season. At the same time, their goalkeeper, who is much less heralded in the wider game, John McLaughlin, has been equally as important for them at the back, and there have been a number of games that they've won narrowly or even drawn when they should have lost, really. And McLaughlin, as he showed in the semi-final against Portsmouth, is definitely their key man at that end of the field. And from Charlton's point of view, they've got an excellent striker called Lyle Taylor who has scored a lot of goals this season. It's basically playing at the best level that he's played at in his career, which has basically entirely taken place in Leagues 1 and League 2. And I think that he could pull the Sunderland centre-backs, who have really been chopped and changed all season. They haven't had a really sort of solid base at the back. I think he could cause them quite a lot of problems. So,
how are you feeling, Barry? Are you nervous yet? When will the nerves kick in?
I'm all right. I've got my ticket sorted. Wilson sorted me out. So he's going corporate. I'm mixing it with the riff-raff.
Oh, marvellous.
Because I'm a man of the people.
Good stuff.
So yeah, I look forward to that.
I want the camera to pan to you with your top off, swirling it around your head.
Nobody wants that.
It's great that we did the whole segment without saying Clive Mendonca or Mickey Gray.
Yeah.
I do actually think it's a good chance it gets to a penalty shootout.
I'm certain it's got to be a penalty shootout. I don't think I've ever been more certain of anything.
I haven't seen enough interviews with Mendonca and Gray yet. I can't believe they haven't been brought together. Who saved Mickey Gray's penalty?
Kuric.
Was it?
Sasa Ilić.
Sasa Ilić. Yeah. Okay.
It didn't take much saving, now, to be fair.
Just picked it up. Villa Derby. Barca Jim, our mate, says, can the panel suggest something else for the commentator to say every 5 minutes in the Derby Villa game than the richest game in world football or the £60 million game or whatever they're going to call it?
It's exceptionally tedious, isn't it? Especially because there is more and more and more an acceptance from certainly fans of clubs in the Championship, if not probably the Premier League fans, to maybe slightly ignorant to this fact, but the very fact of that being the richest game in the world because of the Premier League's revenue that goes to the clubs from the TV deal versus what they get at Championship level and below, that's what's creating quite a very difficult situation and imbalance in our game below the Premier League, certainly, and causing quite a lot of difficulty and strife. So I find it a real shame to hear that used as the tagline. Not to be that tedious bloke that says, you know, we've been covering this all season, but when there's lots to be excited about in terms of the individuals involved, the teams involved, the story arcs of the season, it's frustrating when that gets padded out to quite that extent.
Well, tell us, what are the story arcs?
Oh, you can't move for them. Right. You cannot move for them.
Take me on an arc.
Well, you've got an Aston Villa side who were in the playoff final last season, but a very different looking side under Steve Bruce to what they are now under Dean Smith. And they've certainly found their man to take them to the next level, to take them back up to the Premier League, whether that's now or next season. You would have them down as certainly a favourite if they don't go up. And it's interesting. Villa, as we know, are a storied, historic club with a huge fan base. And actually, for them to have spent 3 years in the Championship now and not to have gone up and to be essentially having this one-off game to go up, it's a bit of a failure from the club since their relegation. They didn't handle that relegation well. It took them two and a half years to get to a point where they seem to be on an even keel. You've got a lot of excellent young players playing in this game, many of whom are on loan from Premier League clubs. So that is an interesting question mark, I think, of these games, that the key players are likely to be loanees who will then go back to Chelsea, Liverpool, etc., which is a shame to some extent. And yet they're such exciting, talented players. It's good to see them playing actual senior football.
Apart from Jack Grealish, of course, but this could be his last game for Villa anyway. Do you think if Villa go up, he'll stay?
You want to think, you know, all of us who have supported teams as children and growing up, you would like to think that he would think, I'll have a season captaining Villa in the Premier League, you know, my absolute dream when I was a youngster. And he is a true Villa fan from his childhood. So you'd hope that he would. The interest in him should be coming from certainly one or two of the top six clubs, if not that next level of Everton's, Leicester's, etc. That's how good he is now. So that is a great part of the story as well, because Grealish is a fantastic player, the sort of player the second tier does not see very often, and it could be a big occasion for him.
Who's your money on?
I think Villa are the favourites, and I think that's fair. So I think the most likely result is a fairly narrow Villa win. They struggled in the semi-finals, and they didn't play particularly well against West Brom. The state of that game, with West Brom scoring quite an early goal in the first leg and then playing a back five with three defensive central midfielders as well, it's very difficult to break down, and they did that very well, and Villa just about got through. My suspicion is that if Derby go ahead, they don't really have the personnel or the sort of solidity to do that to such an effective extent. So I think if Derby go ahead, I'd still have confidence in Villa getting back in the game. If Villa go ahead, their defence has been excellent since the turn of the year, and Tyrone Mings and Tuan Zebe, the centre-backs, both loanees from the Premier League, but they are next-level defenders. So I would back them, if they do go ahead, to see it out more than Derby.
Marcus?
Yeah, I agree. I think Villa's experience, they've got a little bit more experience than Derby. As you said, I think, speaking to some people from Villa, the two signings they made have really transformed them this season. Dean Smith's been excellent. I've obviously been a former Brentford player. I followed him when he was there, and he's transformed Villa. So I'd go for Villa as well on the day.
I don't know.
Graham Potter's joined Brighton on a 4-year deal. Brighton paid Swansea around $3 million in compensation for him and his staff. His assistant manager, Billy Reid, coach Bjorn Hamburg, head of recruitment, Carl McCauley, joined Potter at the Amex. It's a good... It seems like a lot of people saying it's a risk, Ali, but given what he managed to do at Swansea, given how that club was decimated as he was taking over... That seems like a clever appointment.
Yeah, it feels these days, because of the rapid movement of managers and the and how short their lifespan is as a manager, that quite often when you're looking at managers to be appointed at wherever it is, it's hard to find one that hasn't got a blip or hasn't got something that you could point to and say, oh, he didn't do a good job there or he struggled there. Potter is that rarity at the moment where everything he's done has been fantastic. And whether that was in Sweden, in Östersunds, where he had to really go to get his chance in management, completely transforming what was a provincial Swedish club into one of the sort of key players in the Allsvenskan now. But he had to go to the Championship rather than the Premier League to get his chance in English football. And he showed nothing to suggest that he is not a fantastic man-manager, developer of young players, playing a very pleasant style of football, which is something that goes a long way these days. A style of football that often sees... Well, his Swansea team were quite soft defensively, I must say. It's almost going to be... If his Brighton team looks similar, it's going to be the... Very different to how they looked this season. Brighton were sturdy at centre-back, weren't they, with Duffy and Dunk. But Swansea's centre-backs are among the highest passers in the Championship. He's played a central midfield player, Matt Grimes. He's only about 5'9" at centre-back, about 10 times this season, just to have that control right from the back. So
is this the end of Duffy and Dunk? Or do you, what,
I'm
do you
not
get,
saying that.
Do you get Duffy, Dunk, and then stick Cannavaro in between them? Yeah.
Dunk's very accomplished on the ball though, isn't he?
Is
yeah.
He?
Yeah, yeah, very, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not having a go
I've been unfair. I don't get them muddled up. I would know who is who, but they just come as a pair, don't they?
They do.
I'm just saying, if he's going to try and implement that system, which is difficult because the disparity in talent between Brighton's squad and the top 10 is large. It's difficult to impose a passing style to that extent in the Premier League. But if that's what he goes for as his sort of principal tactic, then... Just get used to seeing Duffy and Dunk make 100 passes a game.
Dan James, that move to Manchester United's been delayed, partly because, very sadly, his dad passed away. We know he's quick, Ali. Is he good enough for Manchester United?
He's definitely the quickest player I've seen.
Whatever?
Very possibly.
Wow.
In both without the ball running into space, but also with the ball. There's that difference. Sometimes you get players who are rapid without the ball, but just in terms of having to keep it under control, it slows them down. It doesn't really happen with James. The difficulty there is when I think of a Manchester United winger at the moment, with the current way that most teams will set up, sitting fairly deep against any top team, but United as well, whether pace is really the sort of key skill for a wide man for Manchester United at this stage. If there are games where there's space in behind, he's you know, already in the top tier of pace, and he's developing technically, and under Potter he made very visible improvements throughout the season, which is encouraging. But I don't see him going and making an impact on Premier League games immediately from the start of games, you know, breaking down teams who are sitting deep just yet.
Who's the fastest player you've played against, Marcus?
Played with and against is Nathan Tyson. I don't know if you remember him. Yeah. So he's at Wickham now. He's still the quickest player at the club, and he's 37, maybe 38, wow. Which is incredible. He's like a gazelle, literally.
And does that mean, I'm trying to say this in a nice way, like if you're that quick, why has he not gone higher than Wickham? Because he's...
Oh, no, he has. He's played at Nottingham Forest, Derby. Okay. He's played in the Championship. Okay. So he's played at a good level. So, yeah, he's absolutely rapid.
I suppose Usain Bolt proved that just being fast is not enough to be a footballer.
For sure.
He scored 2 goals in one of the games he played?
I mean, yeah, they're both miss hits, weren't they?
Yeah, he both shanked them both at the bottom corner. But I think what you said was really interesting is about his movement off the ball. I think
it's at the moment, Man United, I think a lot of the players, their wingers want to all come to feet. I think so having that player that can run in behind and make good movements off the ball is important for them.
Could I just ask about the Potter to Brighton thing? Why is the compensation that Brighton have to pay Swansea so low? It seems 3.5 million seems like an absolute steal.
I mean, it always seems that with managers, doesn't it?
I don't understand it.
Does it not come down to maybe how much he's on? Maybe that can obviously play a part. Well,
presumably he's on a contract with Swansea,
but maybe it's not massive wages wise. Potentially,
yeah. I mean, I don't disagree. You sort of wonder, you know, if somebody wants Pochettino, they should be paying £150 million for him because he's clearly that important to a football club. You know, if you're going to spend it on a player,
yeah.
But also, I mean, Dan James, Graham Potter, to some extent, is like the managerial equivalent. Very talented young manager who needs a chance in the Premier League. And United are spending, what is it, 15 million quid on James and only £3 million on Potter. So, yeah, it's definitely something I've not quite got to the bottom of.
After Graham Potter's left Swansea, Ellis James sent this measured tweet. It's a good job I actually hate football and think it's for bad divs. And I'm not absolutely gutted about this. After the Dan James rumours, he seemed remarkably calm. He tweeted, "Ah!" So, thanks, Ellis.
He sent me a couple of text messages laden with profanity.
I think this is something that I like to rail against, and I'm going to use my opportunity to do so now. Swansea under Potter finished something like 14th or 15th in the Championship, a season after they've been playing in the Premier League. And on paper, that looks like an underachievement, doesn't it? We're sort of led to believe that you should be challenging at the top end. And you often see when there's a vacancy, fans will, or sometimes journalist fans will look at someone's win ratio percentage and say, "Oh, it's under 50%. I'm not sure he's good enough." And it completely ignores any context of what the job that they've done was and what their remit was. And clearly, if you dig in a little deeper to Swansea, you'll see that pretty much had all of his key players taken away from him, a load of under 23 players thrust under him, and reignited the fan base's love for the club, which was in serious need of doing so.
No, I think you're right. I think some people say, you know, a club has had its budget slashed, and that tends, as a fan, you sort of hear it, but you don't really hear it. And that clearly makes a big difference if a club has less money to spend on things like paying players, right? It'll change the quality of the player you get. According to the Hartlepool Mail, Gabriel Batistuta is eager to work in England, having completed his coaching badges last year. I don't think they got an exclusive with Batistuta. He's expressed interest in the Middlesbrough job. TalkSport saying that John Terry is in talks with Middlesbrough about becoming their new manager. Marcus, if you had a choice of being managed by Batistuta or Terry, who would you go for?
Batistuta.
Okay. Steve Clark's got the Scotland job, as we suggested he might on Monday. Ewan Murray wrote a 5-point plan for Steve Clark. Point one, ensure the players turn up. although quite important, right? Two, repair the disconnect between the public and the team. Three, make a decision over left back, the Tierney-Robertson dilemma. Pick a formation and stick to it. Four, and prioritise the Scottish top flight. Because Gordon Strachan got a lot of stick for taking players from the Championship as opposed to watching the Scottish Premiership. And he's also says the door is open, Barry, for players who've retired, but he's not going to go and find them. They have to unretire themselves, specifically MacArthur, Alan McGregor, Scott Brown. But it looks like a sensible appointment, doesn't it?
Yeah. I'm not sure they had too many options, to be honest. And if he hadn't wanted the job, I suspect they'd have really struggled to fill it, which seems an awful shame because Scotland used to be a football powerhouse, and now we're sitting here giggling at the fact that a lot of their players can't be arsed turning up for games that are far away, specifically their humiliation in Kazakhstan under Alex McLeish. But Clark's an undeniably good manager. The job he's done at Kilmarnock was outstanding over two seasons, and good luck to him.
It's partly, you know, reading out the 5-point plan there. Isn't it amazing how 40% of the start of one's managerial regime is essentially PR now. You know, repair the relationship between the fans and the national team. That's easier said than done, isn't it? But there are probably a few things, quite simple things, that he has to say and do to at least make a good start. But yeah, he was transformative at Kilmarnock. And, you know, we were talking about managers and how you can always point to something that wasn't amazing on their CV, and some of the jobs that he's had in English football have not always seemed stellar. So what an amazing job he did at Kilmarnock. Notable for me, again, not to belittle Scotland's status in the international game, but they're clearly not at the in the top tier. His record against Rangers and Celtic at Kilmarnock, I think he basically played, it was something like 18 games against the old firm, 6 wins, 6 draws and 6 defeats, which is about as good as it gets for a non-old firm team. So if he can do whatever he did there, translate that to Scotland's games against the likes of Belgium, who they've got coming up, and start picking up points where previously there were none, that would be a very good start.
Do you ever draw up a 5-point plan, Barry? Do you ever take a blank sheet of paper and say, here's what I'm going to do with my life?
No.
Marcus?
No. Sounds like a good idea. I might try it.
Yeah, it does sound like a good idea. I would struggle at point one.
Do you workshop? I do it. I have like, I divide it into four, and I have like work, what I've got to try and achieve. House, you know, I've got always got to audit stuff. There's always stuff I've got to chuck away.
Gutters, clear them.
Always have fitness. And then I say whatever the next month is, I'm going to go big on fitness in. So I've got Fit June coming up. Obviously, that'll move to Fit July, midway through June, and then miscellaneous.
But I definitely need a 5...
Four categories of life.
Yeah.
I definitely need a 5 or possibly 10-point plan to, like, I need to ship a lot of weight, try and get fit, give up smoking, drink less.
These are all in the better. Fitness quadrant.
All those sort of things. Need. I'm beginning to realise they need urgent attention, because I'm not getting any younger, but I am getting bigger.
I just do the classic, write something in the notes section of my phone on the tube and then discover it about 6 months later. Yeah. And be like, oh, yeah, I was going to do that, wasn't I?
Kieran Tierney is fit for the Scottish Cup final against Hearts on Saturday. He's then going to miss Scotland's Euro 2020 qualifiers against Cyprus and Belgium. He'll not feature. He's going to have a double hernia operation. That's in his fitness quadrant. He'll not feature for Steve Clark's first game against Cyprus on the 8th of June or Belgium 3 days later. As producer Jonathan points out, the last time a fullback missed some games for a medical procedure, it went very well, didn't it? When Andy Robertson missed the game with Kazakhstan with dental surgery and they lost 3-0. Also in FitBar, Scottish Premiership playoff, Sunday 3 p.m. St Mirren versus Dundee United. So good luck to both of you. And that'll end part two. In part three, we'll ask the question, Marcus Bean, what next? Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. We'll begin with Marcus Bean, what's next? So you were at Wickham, released by Wickham. Talk us through how that works. Do you go into the manager's office? Do they just text you? What's the process?
Yeah, you just get a text saying, oh, can you come in for a meeting? So it was on the Wednesday after the final game of the season. Went in there as the manager, the chairman, and the assistant manager. And yeah, just thanks but no thanks, basically.
And did you know that was going to happen? I mean, I've had those meetings at Sky. They wait until you've recorded everything possibly so you can't do a dirty protest on TV.
You kind of get a feeling it's going to come. This time I wasn't too sure if it was coming or not. But when it did, it was all amicable. Me and the manager are friends, and we will continue to be.
You didn't sort of say, oh, please, or anything like that. You didn't.
No, there's no begging.
And you were working for quite a long time, weren't
you? I was, yeah. I think it was like 4 or 5 seasons, which is a long time for players at that level now. And so many great memories. But as you say, all good things must come to an end.
What's the best one?
Best one is promotion. I think you that, as a player, that's the icing on the cake of 9 months of hard graft. And when you do it with such a special group that we did, that was a really special moment.
Staying up this season, got to be up there. Yeah. I mean, this is a strange thing to say, but when we're doing our pre-season previews and you go through who's ever unsigned, if you just look at the squad page on Wikipedia, Wickham's barely covers one line. They've normally got about 15, 16 sometimes at the start of the season, professionals heading into the season. The budget restraints and the thinness of the squad, an unbelievable achievement to stay up this season.
Yeah, and it was a bit of an anticlimax because I've been in a relegation battle with, for example, Colchester, where we've been in that trouble all season. And then when you get out of it, it's like, wow, this is some relief. But when you've been mid-table up until January and you've kind of plummet, it's like a sense of like underachievement because you felt what more could have happened. And that's the kind of feeling in the dressing room after the final game of the season. We're all disappointed with ourselves because we felt, yeah, granted we had a small squad, but we felt like we let ourselves down.
Look, you're bright and you have plans, right? But this moment is sort of can be quite a seminal moment in a footballer's career when you're mid-30s, club says see you later, and a lot of footballers have really struggled with that moment.
Yeah, it's a weird feeling. Previously, when I've been out of contract, I've been pretty upbeat and positive about, and I still am, but more so the fact that I'm going to walk into another club or get another club. I felt that, you know, I'm in a great position. And now, obviously, we get to 35. It's a little bit different. You know, those phone calls don't come as often, and you've got to really, just as I said before, you've got to try and remain positive and think about what's next.
What do you want to do?
So I want to be a director of football. So I've already enrolled on the course, Masters in Sporting Directorship at Salford University. So my focus is on that at the moment. I've bought my reading list and I'm really studying towards that. But I also love coaching. So I do 10 hours a week with a company called Toka Football, coaching young kids, which I love and really enjoy as well.
Do you want to be the director of football of Polytechnic Fours in the Southern Amateur League Intermediate Junior Division Four?
I could be. What's the rates?
You play as well. You pay me £135 for the year and £12 a game.
Wow.
It's rolling subs, but I guarantee you like 60 minutes.
Can I bring in my own management staff and stuff like that? Or?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
As long as you pick me.
I'm really interested in the fact that you're targeting the director of football role and very open about it, because I think this is a relatively new thing for pros who are retiring. And we were discussing it on the podcast the other day that, because of the success of a team like Norwich and so much championing of that structure that they put in place with the head coach Farker, the sporting director Stuart Webber, and this great sort of synergy between everyone, departments working together with common goals and bringing through young players and just generally getting governance of a football club right. What you're going to see is a lot of teams trying to replicate that. But unlike the management pool, when you sack your manager and there's a number of people who apply for the job, there isn't really a pool of directors of football or sporting directors because it's still a relatively new part of the game. So if you can establish yourself over the next few years as, I am a director of football, I am qualified and I have experience in the game, it strikes me that's quite a really good path to go down, especially because, well, at this stage at least, you're less likely to get sacked after a few months than you are if you want to try and be a manager and get into what is such a competitive pool of job description, basically.
Exactly, and I've got very distinct ways of I like the game to be played, and as you said about being sacked after 5 months or so, you're less likely, obviously, in that role, and you get more chance to implement it and bring in the right people to really make a success of a football club. And as we know, there's so many clubs that are badly run. Mm. There's so much room for improvement in that area, and I've looked at that role for years on the continent and always never quite understood why we weren't doing it in England, and now we're kind of catching up, and I think it's a vital role in any football club.
I think it's actually something to do with the British psyche and the egos of people at the top.
Yeah, egos of managers a lot of the time, they think they can do it all themselves, whereas in any other business structure there's a team behind you helping you.
How do you like the game to be played? What is beanball?
Beanball's
isn't that a hacky sack?
It might be.
Beanball's playing the ball out from the back, playing through the thirds, attacking football, high press, high energy, and with a high I want young players playing for me.
Okay.
How do you think Colly Forrest would adapt to bean ball, Max?
I'm not interested. I don't want my defenders anywhere near the ball. Their job is to tackle. I'm not interested in young players because I'm playing. So I withdraw my offer. Look, good luck. Certainly. Yeah. Sorry, Barry.
I'm not sure energetic pressing from the club being your forte either, would it?
Imagine. Good luck. And we will obviously keep tabs. If you get a full-time sporting director role, you still have to come in and do the pod occasionally.
For sure.
Excellent news. All right, more manager news then. Antonio Conte's agreed terms with Inter to take over as their new manager in the summer. Paolo's been suggesting this would happen for quite a long time. The former Juve manager has not worked since leaving Chelsea in 2018. It's not a huge surprise, is it, Conte going there?
No, he's just settled his pay dispute with Chelsea, hasn't he? Trouser 9 million, and he's going to be on apparently the same amount per annum at Inter, who haven't yet secured Champions League football. They need to beat, I think, is it Empoli at home to guarantee it on Sunday? But,
Sam Allardyce's grandson, also named Sam Allardyce, has just signed a 1-year contract for Oxford United. You sent quite a funny tweet, Barry.
Fun size Sam.
I mean, it's probably little Sam, isn't it? If Sam is big Sam, then his son Sam, presumably he has a son Sam, is just Sam, normal Sam.
Hopefully he's a fireman. That would be convenient.
Normal Sam, and then it'd be little Sam. Little Sam Allardyce, 1-year contract for Oxford United. Did we enjoy Asamoah Gyan retiring from international football and then unretiring a day later? He scored 51 in 106 internationals. He said on Monday he'd quit permanently after being replaced as captain. He said, upon consultation with my family and team, and as an active footballer and captain of the national team, if the decision of the coach is to give captaincy of the tournament to another player while I am named in the team for the tournament, I wish to recuse myself from the tournament. I wish to retire from the national team permanently, not pretending my presence would not fuel the purported undermining the country has seen under my captaincy. I would continue to serve the country Ghana in other endeavours as a businessman through various investments. The president, Nana Akufo-Addo, spoke to Jean on Tuesday, and Asamoah said, a presidential request is one that cannot be disregarded. I have taken the request in good faith and will make myself available for selection by the coach. Is that fair enough? I mean, I'm easily...
I had no idea he was still playing, for a start. He was at Sunderland and then abandoned them for
the Middle East.
The Middle East and the filthy lucre that was available there. And then there was some mysterious incident in the last couple of years involving someone going missing off a speedboat.
Oh, right.
That I really should have brushed up on before I came into the room.
Could be writing for The Guardian using words like recused. Really nice that.
Yeah, I find it baffling when people sort of get upset over, or get obsessed, as say the English media seem to do, over captaincy of teams. And, you know, just be the captain, don't be the captain, it doesn't matter.
Yeah. I mean, I'm so easily swayed that if I quit a job and then the Queen rang me and said, would you reconsider? I'd probably go, yeah, if it's that important, why not? He scored at 6 consecutive Nations Cup finals, as well as 3 World Cups between 2006 and 2014. He's not featured for the national side since 2017 September after persistent injury problems. So that's, you know, arguably a reason.
Exactly, yeah. If you're a captain, you're meant to be selfless. And if you ain't played since 2017, and so the manager says, listen, I'm going to give it to somebody else. And yeah, it's just an ego thing, I think, for Gian, to be honest.
The only downside, all of those wonderful achievements, but I think he wore number 3 on the back of his shirt, or number 2 when he played for Sunderland, and that, for a striker, it's not on.
Although I didn't mind Clint Dempsey doing it.
Well, what did he wear, 2?
Yeah,
his nickname is Deuce, to be fair. Yeah, so that would have been,
you know, but still
it looks wrong. It just looks
wrong.
I
don't know what Asamoah Gyan's nickname may have been. Trio. I don't know. But no, I'm with you there. I like 2 and 3 fullbacks, 5 and 6 centre backs, 4 and 8 centre mids,
7-11, 9-10.
So
yeah.
Simple.
Yeah. And you have to play 4-4-2, nothing else. None of your beanball nonsense. Finally, a question and completely apropos, nothing to do with TV detectives, from Bruno. For the panel, who would you rather share a pint with? Rebus, Morse, Wallander or Montalbano?
Rebus, definitely.
Morse, for me.
Don't know the other two, so I'll go Morse.
Okay. I'll go Montalbano. I think he's in Sicily, I think. So it would be... It wouldn't be a pie. It would be a glass of, red wine with Montalbano.
I think if Rebus and I went out, get seriously out of hand. That could go on for a few days.
Rebus doing an important job with a bad attitude. That's you with the footballing journalist answer to Rebus, aren't you?
We have a lot in common. Put it that way.
All right. Well, listen. Thanks very much for your time. Thanks, Marcus.
Cheers, guys.
Thanks, Ali.
Thank you.
Cheers, Baz.
Thanks.
We'll be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.